Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. Welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, what do we actually need to do to stay hydrated in the valley during the summer? And we celebrate the birthday of an American icon. But first, it is time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
I've had the chance to work with him directly on many issues and have seen firsthand his dedication to the American people. And I know the governors know what it takes to deliver for their states, and I am confident that Governor Walz and Vice President Harris will deliver for Arizona.
She is very familiar with what Rudy Giuliani and other national figures were doing during that time frame, and we think that she provides additional and different information.
The time has come for us as Arizona Republicans to admit the obvious. And to start saying the quiet part out loud, which is that our party's nominee is not qualified for office.
Congressman Gallego and I definitely don't agree on everything, but I'm standing here and we're all standing here because we care about the future of our great state. We care about the character of our leaders and because we want a better future for our kids.
So hopefully with the history of his previous recusals and the long history of his many problematic statements about this organization and this case, that he'll do the right thing here again.
And joining me to talk about new developments in the case of the so-called fake electors, VP Kamala Harris picking her running mate and the two of them campaigning in Arizona and more, are Chip Scutari of SNC Communications. Good morning, Chip.
Happy Friday.
And Sam Richard of Consilium Consulting. Sam, good to see you.
Great to be here.
So let's start, Sam, and I'll start with you on Tim Walz, the governor of Minnesota, becoming Kamala Harris's running mate. The two of them will be in Glendale this afternoon, for a rally after sort of barnstorming through a number of Midwestern states. Specifically for Arizona, does Walz help Harris in this state at all, do you think?
I think absolutely and clearly, not only on a personal level. I'm a son of two public school teachers who graduated from the University of Minnesota. So I think that I'm not unique in the fact that it's a lot easier to shovel the sun. So a lot of our early migratory patterns were folks that came from the Midwest. So I think that Governor Walz's affect and his approach to policy, his approach to being a good neighbor and a decent man, filled with some memorable quips and joy and hope along for the ride, is going to really resonate well here in Arizona.
Chip, what do you think? Does Walz help? I mean, obviously the sort of the conventional wisdom with the running mate is do no harm, right? Like
you exactly.
Don't want them to mess things up for the top of the ticket. Does he help Harris in Arizona? Does he potentially cause harm here?
I think he does a great help in balancing the ticket. Vice President Harris has not won a solo campaign when it's just been her in the ballot outside of the liberal bastion of California. So I think Tim Walz with the kind of aw shucks Midwestern dad vibe really balances that out. I think he can help with white working class folks. And I think, you know, if you think of Donald Trump versus Governor Walz, you know, Donald Trump may be that leaf blower that you're hearing over and over, which I do on my morning walks. I hear leaf blowers like, oh. And compare that to Tim Walz. He may be your neighbor who, when you go on vacation, you say, hey, Tim, can you mow my lawn? You know, he's got that aw shucks kind of personality, but he's also super smart and he's been engaged and done a lot of different things in his career. And I think just objectively looking at it, you know, the Democrat base coalition is back since Kamala Harris got in the race and President Biden stepped down. The electoral map has shifted. Arizona, Georgia, Nevada are now in play. So they're riding momentum. I think Republicans, even the biggest Trump supporters, would admit they have the energy, they have the momentum now. Can they keep it until Election Day, or at least until early voting starts, is the big challenge right now.
Well, so how much, Chip, do you think Arizona is in play now that the race is set, we assume, between now and November? You know, because earlier when President Biden was in the race, Arizona was – the polls were showing it was not particularly close, mm-hmm. that former President Trump was pretty far ahead here. Do you really think Arizona is in play now for Vice President Harris?
I do. I think it'll be super close, you know, one on the margins like it was in 2020. I don't know if it'd be as close as 10,457 votes or whatever it was in 2020. But I do think it's in play. And I think Walz, you know, whatever, you know, people go after his record being too progressive with, you know, things he did in Minnesota that may not play in rural Arizona. But I think he's kind of a natural campaigner. And the one thing you notice just looking at it objectively is him and the vice president seem to get along. They're so different. They come from two way different parts of the country. Mm-hmm. But they seem to just generally get along. You can tell on stage if candidates are awkward, you know. But they seem to, you know, have a genuine embrace. They seem to get along. And I think he'll be a great balance of the ticket. And I think – and we've all seen in presidential campaigns, whether it's Barack Obama, Ronald Reagan, or Donald Trump, personalities do trump policy. So nerds like us will re-examine and vet their policies. Most Joe Sixpack and Jane Sixpack out there aren't going to know every policy that they support or don't support.
Absolutely. And I'd rather share a six-pack with Governor Walz and Vice President Harris than the folks on the other ticket. Absolutely. And I think another important, you know, thing to – enter into the conversation here is that, you know, we talk a lot about different voting blocks and kind of how they ebb and flow. You know, Democrats running for president have lost fewer rural counties since Clinton in 92 in every subsequent presidential election. So I think having someone who represented rural southern Minnesota and has that affect coming onto the presidential ticket, I think that you're going to see some of that reversal. That Republican candidates and especially in Trump have kind of dug into in rural counties. And I think you'll see that play out here in Arizona, too.
Well, Sam, let me ask you, because obviously Mark Kelly, Arizona senator, Arizona's junior senator, was on the short list of finalists to be Vice President Harris's running mate. And there was some conversation that Kelly might be able to help Harris with what seems to be, at least based on what Republicans are talking about right now, kind of a weak point, which is the border and her role in trying to deal with the border, whatever you want to call her actual title. Do you think that Walz is able to in any way help with that? Or maybe do you consider potentially a missed opportunity to not select Mark Kelly and sort of try to shore up that potential weakness?
Yeah, I mean, despite my Minnesota homerism, you know, Arizona is home and I'm proud of it. So obviously, I think that it was a missed opportunity in some senses. But, you know, the fact that Senator Kelly was an important part of the conversation shows how important Arizona is going to be to this ticket. And I think also because of the strength and the early momentum that the Harris ticket has shown, you had an opportunity to kind of think further ahead. And I think that Senator Kelly is going to be an important voice in a very tight U.S. Senate that supports a Harris-Walz administration.
Chip, do you think this gives Kelly a little more maybe gravitas in D.C.?
Absolutely. He was talked about for the last 2 weeks as, you know, the final three candidates for VP. But I think one of the things in D.C. or the powers that be in the Democratic National Party were worried about is if Mark Kelly was on the ticket and they won – you know, Governor Hobbs would appoint another Democrat, mm-hmm. but they'd be up for a re-election or they'd have to run for election in 2026. And that could be a dicey proposition. You know, Mark Kelly's a pretty special candidate with a very unique bio, being a fighter pilot and astronaut. So I don't know how much that came into play, but I'm sure it did somewhat.
We've already had that an exhausting series of, what is it, five or six U.S.
Let's
Senate
keep
elections.
The streak going. Right? Come on. We're going to miss it next time. So, Chip, last point on the presidential race. I want to ask you about the Republicans for Harris Group. We heard a clip from Mesa Mayor John Giles just a moment or two ago. It would seem that, you know, the sort of the conventional wisdom is for a Democrat to win in Arizona, you need Republican votes. I mean, how broad-based do you anticipate this coalition is going to be? And will it be enough to really help Vice President Harris?
Yeah, as I mentioned before, you know, this election is going to be super tight, one on the margins. But I think a popular mayor of Arizona's third largest city, like Mayor Giles of Mesa, can really help in the East Valley. And if you look at the election results between Kerry Lake and Pinal County Sheriff Mark Lamb in the Senate race, mm-hmm. the one area where he did better than her is the East Valley. So if Mayor Giles and, you know, former McCain advisors like Paul Hickman, the CEO of the Arizona Bankers Association, Bettina Nava, another close McCain advisor, if they get out and really campaign hard in the East Valley for Harris, that could help put her over the top. And there's an excellent story in Axios about how the LDS voters, Mormon voters, could help swing this elections in a few key places across the country. So we'll have to pay attention to that.
Yeah, Sam, how do you anticipate the Harris-Walz ticket trying to appeal to maybe the McCain Republicans that, as Chip said, could be key in you know, determining whether the Democrats or Republicans win Arizona.
Yeah, I think to kind of build on what Chip was saying earlier, I think that more and more over the last few election cycles, especially in kind of a Trump-dominated world, you're seeing political conversations focus less on which team jersey you're wearing and kind of what you care more about. And I think that this idea of Republicans for Harris has a lot more to do with the joy and hope and decency that that ticket is bringing versus kind of the charred earth vision of America that, that the Trump-Vance ticket is seeming to purport.
All right. So, guys, let me ask you about another pretty significant story this week. That is a couple of developments in the so-called fake electors case that the attorney, Arizona Attorney General's office is working on. We saw that a former Trump attorney, Jenna Ellis, took a plea deal to cooperate with prosecutors. We then saw another of the so-called fake electors plead guilty to a lesser charge. Sam, how significant are these in this overall case?
I think it's incredibly significant because it could be the start or the tip of, you know, a kind of an avalanche that, that starts to come down in terms of momentum in this, and just continue to be impressed with every move that Attorney General Mays makes in this case and you know, showing herself as a fantastically capable litigator.
Chip, Jenna Ellis had also taken a similar deal in, I believe, Georgia and another state where there's a similar case. I would imagine that prosecutors believe, and we heard Attorney General May say it, that she has information that could really help make this case for them.
Yeah, I mean, most Americans, they're familiar probably with Jenna Ellis because she was standing right behind Rudy Giuliani when it had his hair dye meltdown when it was coming down the side of his face. It was pretty frightening stuff. So, yeah, she was right at the top. She was working hand in glove with Rudy Giuliani, who was the personal attorney for former President Donald Trump. So I think this is a huge deal just to build on what Sam said, because it's harder for these other defendants to say this is a political witch hunt when one of their co-defendants has admitted to committing these crimes. So it's a big deal. Now, Jenna Ellis has to deliver the goods or else she could be in big trouble. You know, they're going to waive, you know, all her felonies, but my legal experts tell me that if she doesn't or says anything wrong or, you know, doesn't bring the goods, that she could be in trouble and they could reinstitute those felonies against her. So she's got a lot to do. She's got a lot of big responsibility on her shoulders.
And Chip, in terms of Lorraine Pellegrino, one of the other so-called fake electors pleading guilty, does that seem like a significant development in trying to figure out what actually happened and try to get some prosecutions if you're the attorney general's office?
Absolutely. I mean, we've seen this in big court, big cases like this. The first to flip, you know, this, you know, Lorraine Pellegrino and Jenna Ellis, they usually get the best deals, you know, the sweetheart deals, so to speak. So I got to think these other co-defendants, you know, like Jake Hoffman and others, are probably really worried behind the scenes because they know that Jenna Ellis is going to spill the goods on them. And I think what Sam said, the AG's office is doing a good job of building this case brick by brick and not reaching too far too fast.
Sam, let me start with you about a judge ruling that the summary that supporters of the Abortion Access Initiative put with their signature petitions was not misleading, allowed it to stay on the ballot for now. This ruling, it seems as though, is going to be appealed. This is, of course, just one of the areas of litigation around this initiative. When all is said and done, do you anticipate this will be on the ballot?
Absolutely. I mean, I think much like Bon Jovi, right, and 100 million fans can't be wrong, you have a record-setting number of folks sign the petition. So it was clearly not misleading. Every legal hurdle that is grasping at straws from anti-abortion proponents have been throwing up there has been swatted away by courts and you name it. So I think that this is going to carry this momentum all the way to victory in November, and it's going
to
happen.
So to continue your analogy, it's not living on a prayer.
No,
is what
not
you're
at
saying.
All. Not at all.
Chip, are you a little surprised that Justice Bill Montgomery decided not to recuse himself after having recused himself in a prior case over this initiative?
No, I'm not surprised. I'm really not surprised at all. But I don't know even though why we're talking about this, because yesterday at his kind of meandering press conference, Donald Trump said abortion's not a big deal in this election. So, but on a serious note, you know, whatever the wording is, you know, it's going to be hashed out in court. But this is a fundamental core issue for people, whether you're for this or against it. So I think the wording, while important and critical to especially to the pro side, I don't think it will make or break it. I think the 800,000 plus people who signed this petition to get this on the ballot won't be swayed by those three words. And And I agree with Sam that if it's on the ballot, it's going to pass overwhelmingly and be a big boost to the Democratic ticket.
So, Chip, let me stick with you about the Tipped Workers Protection Act. This also will, at least for now, stay on the ballot after a judge ruled that the name of the initiative was not misleading. Critics had said it might actually hurt tipped workers. This comes at the same time that a minimum wage increase withdrew their signatures, thinking that maybe they didn't have enough to survive challenges of signatures. When you talk about, you know, for example, the abortion measure helping the Democratic ticket, the border security initiative is presumed to help the Republican ticket. Does this one or the two of them potentially like have an impact on turnout or any other races, do you think?
I think the Border Security Act could if they can fund a good campaign. This one, you know, I got to say, even for us news junkies, most people don't know what the Tip Workers Protection Act is. And I read it and I've been researched it before we talked about it. It really depends on how it affects the consumers. Is this good for customers? But I think it's so down ballot and we're going to have, three pages of stuff to vote on.
Yeah, it could be.
I don't think this is going to sway the election either way. I do think depending on how well funded the Border Security Act is, that could help Republican turnout. But this issue I don't think will.
Sam, do you agree? Is this a little – you know, like not 1A, 1B, but sort of a B level of interest initiative?
I think that's clearly the point that I most resonated with as Chip was talking through that in terms of, you know, this is going to be a 3 or 4 page ballot. And by the time you get there, you know, you might have voters asking, you know, the person on the other side, please add a dollar for my work here, right? So you're going to look for a lot of confusion that far down the ballot. And I think that people might just abstain from even participating in that particular initiative.
So, Sam, let me ask you quickly about the minimum wage issue. The supporters of that had said they're basically going to try to get this through the legislature. Seems like they're kind of banking maybe on at least one of the chambers flipping to Democrats, because I would imagine it would be pretty difficult to get a minimum wage increase through a Republican-controlled legislature.
I would absolutely agree with that. I think that you know, despite what I was saying earlier around a post-partisan kind of move, I think that is one of those areas where clearly Democrats want to support fair and living wages, and there's a divergent thought on the Republican side of the conversation. So I think that if the Democrats do flip a chamber, it would likely be the upper chamber in the state Senate. And if that conversation happens, then it would be a very important piece of leverage even in a shared leadership environment next session.
So, Chip, let me ask you. I always love asking people to wade into other parties' internal politics.
Sure.
The race in the 3rd Congressional District between Yasemin Ansari and Raquel Turan is going to a recount. A 42-vote margin kind of makes Chris Mayes look like a landslide.
I know, wow.
From a couple of years ago. Do you have any reason to think that Ansari, Phoenix City Council member, will not come out on top once the recount is done?
You know, in all the years I covered political campaigns or worked on campaigns or observed them, it's very rare that a recount changes the outcome. So I think, unless barring some unusual, you know, counting or something weird happening, I think, you know, Ansari will be the next congressional member from that district. And as we all know, that's a heavily D district.
Mm-hmm.
She's very young, very smart, very ambitious. She could be there probably as long as she wants. Maybe her first term, there'll be a challenge after that from another Democrat if something goes haywire. But you know, it's pretty impressive what she's accomplished at such a young age, you know, depending what you think of her partisan policies. But she's a rising star in Arizona.
Sam, are there any lessons to take from the fact that this race between two Democrats, which got a little bit testy, especially toward the end, was ultimately decided by a really, really small margin?
Yeah, and that margin for fans of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is pretty important, right? 42 is the answer. So I think that, you know, what it told me more than anything else is that we have quality candidates up and down the ballot as Democrats to choose from. There was a highly contested race in the 1st Congressional District as well. Chip mentioned Councilwoman Ansari's impressive resume. Raquel Turan also has an incredible track record of service and a demonstrable history of great change and movement building here in Arizona as well. So I think voters in the 3rd District were well served by that conversation and choice.
Would you agree, Sam, that at the end of the day, maybe the margin won't be 42, but that Councilwoman Ansari will ultimately be the winner?
I think that if past performance is an indicator of future results, I think that it is very difficult to say that there would be a change.
Okay. So, guys, we just have about a minute or two left here. I want to ask, you know, the sort of the dust from the primary has settled now, you know, a little more than a week out. Sam, what are you most looking toward for November? Like, what are you most looking to see, you know, draw signs from, or, you know, sort of divine, you know, what might happen?
Yeah, I was most intrigued by a litany of observations about how small the margin Carrie Lake had over Mark Lamb. I think that she was only going to have a fighter's chance if she crossed that 60 or 65% margin. And I think she's in real trouble, which, you know, we've always known was a possibility, but I think that was cemented on Tuesday. It's also going to be interesting that perhaps the County Board of Supervisors could be democratically held here in Maricopa County in the first time half a century.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see, after living in Arizona all these years, where every 2 years my Democratic friends will say, we're going to flip the State House, we're going to flip the Senate. This year, let's see if the energy from the Harris-Walls ticket, if that has any momentum down ballot, and if they take either the state senate or state house would be such a huge deal for them. But I still think it's tricky. I still think Republicans, not being partisan here, I still think they could hold the House and Senate just the way these elections hold out. And it will be really interesting to see how the next couple of months go and if they can flip a House or Senate, because that's a big deal for Governor Hobbs going into her reelect in 2026.
Sure. All right. Yeah. We'll have to leave it there. Chip Scutari, Sam Richard, thanks you both for coming in. Thanks for the conversation.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up today is Smokey Bear's birthday. We'll take a look back at his legacy. But first, living in the valley, especially around this time of year, we all hear about the importance of staying hydrated and drinking enough water. But how much is actually enough, and what happens if we don't hit that target? With me to talk more about this is Stavros Kavouris, a professor of nutrition in ASU's College of Health Solutions and founding director of the Hydration Science Lab. And Stavros, as I mentioned, we've all heard about the need to drink water and that if you're thirsty, it's probably too late. Do you get the sense that people here recognize how much we need to drink to stay healthy and hydrated?
Yeah, this is a great question, actually. And you touch upon a couple things. So whether we are well hydrated, and I think the most important question is whether we can rely on thirst, and second, how much we're supposed to drink. So let me take it apart a little bit. So relying on thirst is, I would say relying on thirst or drinking according to thirst is a great survival tool. If you want just to survive, you can rely on thirst. If you want to optimize health, if you want to be like at your best, drinking to thirst probably is not the best way to go.
So what should the guide be then? I mean, I've seen, for example, people with, you know, water bottles that have times and, you know, levels on them. You should have had this much to drink by this time, this much to drink. Like, is there a good guide that we should be using?
So there are dietary guidelines on how much water we're supposed to drink. Those obviously are guidelines that they are designed, like all the dietary guidelines, for population level and not necessarily for individual level, and they're not great for every condition. So it's not the best for somebody who lives in the winter in Alaska versus somebody who is down here in the valley in the middle of the summer with 110 being almost a daily experience. So how much we should drink? I think the thirsty could be probably, you can use thirst as a first a warning that you're not probably drinking enough. So having access to water and having water close to you, it's very, very important. If you notice, I still have not answered your question, how much you're supposed to drink. So I've been trying to dance around the answer. So instead of giving you an amount, what I would like to give more, which is a little bit more practical, is give some signs that can really help you to stay better hydrated. And the best signs that I can give that they're based on science and data that we have published over the year, both my lab and other scientists around the world, is looking at two very specific indices. And one of them, which is very, very simple, is how often you pee, how often you go to the bathroom to urinate. And the second one, how dark is your urine?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to the bathroom every 2 to 3 hours, and if your urine is quite diluted, then both of those are very strong indications that you're consuming adequate amount of fluids. If you're not, so for instance, you wake up in the morning, you go to the bathroom, and then you go to work and you don't visit the restroom until noon probably, this is a sign that you're not drinking enough.
So given what we know about the importance of hydration and not just, as you say, surviving, but really optimizing health, when you're looking at policies to try to keep people safe and healthy in a place like Phoenix at a time like the summer, how big of a priority for you would be making sure people have access to good drinking water?
Yeah, this is, I know it might sound a little bit cliche, but water access is a human right. I know some people like to compare drinking water to breathing air. It is very important. It's if you follow the dietary guidelines on how much water we're supposed to drink every day, and if you do the math, an average human being consumes close to 1 ton of water per year. So if you compare that, let's say, with proteins, we consume maybe 40, 50 pounds per year for somebody who is an average body weight. So we really consume a lot of water. And we know, even though we need to drink so much water, and even though our body is mainly made out of water, a small decrease in water content, as little as 1%, we see a significant negative impact on both health outcomes, cognitive function, and performance, physical performance.
So it is a matter of sort of life and death in many ways. But it sounds like what you're saying is it's also a matter of assuming that you have enough to survive. It's a matter of what kind of quality of life you're going to have if you have enough access to water or not.
Absolutely. That makes a huge difference.
So for people who, at least in theory, have access to adequate supplies of drinking water, do we drink enough, not just to survive, but to, as you say, to really optimize our health?
Yeah. So going back to the question, drinking to thirst, most people drink based on thirst. So by the time you get thirsty and you start drinking, you're already behind on optimal hydration. So most people do not drink according to the guidelines. So majority of people do not meet the dietary guidelines, especially if you look data on kids. And kids, I'm referring anybody from 0 to 18 years old, and also in older adults 65 plus. If you look at these two specific categories, a grand majority of those people, they're not consuming enough fluids. And if you measure hydration biomarkers, they're not optimally hydrated either.
Well, it's really interesting because what you're saying is you cannot and maybe should not rely on feeling thirsty to know that it's time to drink and that you need to have more water, which is the opposite of what we often hear about eating, where, you know, don't eat unless you're actually hungry. Your body doesn't really need it. It's such an interesting juxtaposition between these two things that are so vital to, you know, to humans being able to survive, but very different, it seems, mechanisms for us to know how much we need and when we should do each.
Yeah, this is, you're very right. I think the for different reasons, for nowadays, for eating, we say you should eat less than you think you're supposed to eat, because now the problem is not people dying from malnutrition or not having access to food. We're on the opposite side, at least for most of the people, at least in the planet. So now we say eat a little bit less to avoid obesity, which is one of the major health issues now. And for hydration, we say drink a little bit more just to be better hydrated. Because one of the difficult things with hydration is that we don't know exactly how much you will need to drink, because your needs is defined by two primary factors. One of them is how physically active you are, and the second one is how hot is the environment. So when you combine those two, if you're very physically active and it's a you live in a very hot environment, then your needs could be tremendously higher than most people that they live in air-conditioned areas and they're not that much physically active.
All right. Well, Stavros, thank you so much for the conversation. Thanks for your insights. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Stavros Kavouras is a professor of nutrition in ASU's College of Health Solutions and founding director of the Hydration Science Lab. The Olympic breaking competition kicked off this morning. It is the first and possibly the last time it's been part of the Games. Breaking will not be in the 2028 Summer Olympics. Breaking didn't start out as a sport with rules and points, but these days it's all about sponsors and worldwide to a lot of young breakers. J. Edson House Magana isn't sure that's entirely a good thing. He grew up breaking and teaches hip-hop as a clinical assistant professor at ASU. When my co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with Magana last fall, he said Olympic breaking could be a good thing, but only if it's done right.
I personally started in Chicago. I grew up in Chicago, and that's where I was first introduced to breaking and to, you know, what we now know as hip-hop culture. But even before me, it was when it was going on, it wasn't even called breaking. They didn't even have a name for it. It was just going off. Or it was just part of life. It's just what people did. It was a rites of passage for kids. Mm. You didn't see much on TV until like movies like Beat Street and Breaking came out, which gave a big explosion in the 80s. That's part of the history that we're trying to make sure that we don't repeat, because when it got put into the industrial machine kind of thing, it got played out. I mean, it got corny where everybody was doing it. There was on every McDonald's and Burger King commercial. And Ronald McDonald was battling the Burger King guy and, you know, and things like that. So it got really played out. Toys R Us was selling like cardboard breaking boxes, like dance floors. And, you know, it wasn't cool to do it anymore. So folks like myself still did it kind of in the closet, like, you know, on our own. But you couldn't bring it out in public anymore because it was like, you're still doing that thing. And it just got really super commercialized and it got played out. And it just got used up and then it was left to the side. Kind of went underground, let's say, for a while after that. And then in the 90s, it came back pretty hard. And those were these raw jams that were happening. It was events kind of like the B-Boy Summit in California, the Rocksteady Anniversary in New York, Pro-Am in Miami. Early on, they didn't necessarily have structured contests, but you still went and traveled on your own dime, on your own time. Just to go meet people from these other villages, from these other places, so you could come back to your own village and be like, oh, you know what, in New York, this is how they do it. You know, we got smoked in New York.
So it was organic.
Yeah, it was very organic, very raw. You know, but little by little, it started to get it more structured, where you had more organized competitions. You know, you have people like Red Bull. A Red Bull BC1 event is probably the Super Bowl of breaking events. They have qualifiers all over the world and you can go compete worldwide. Yeah. There's Red Bull athletes and Monster athletes, people that are not getting paid and, you know, sustaining a life from this stuff. So it's very much become organized in that kind of sense. Obviously, you know, corporations are starting to get involved with it. And it's great, you know, it's great that the Olympics is interested again, because it's not the first time they've seen us. They've seen us before in the 80s when they used people for like a halftime show. And I'm not at all like trying to disregard the Olympics or any of these things. It would be great to have a good relationship with all these big corporations, with all these big organizations, a healthy relationship where we're both sitting at the table and seeing what's really best for everybody. Understanding that this is a culture and an art and it comes, you know, from marginalized communities.
So it sounds like you're worried about the art form essentially being co-opted.
Yeah. I mean, it's like I said, we already saw it in the 80s. We already saw what happened. And, you know, the community was much younger then. So they were literally dealing with kids so they could offer them a pair of shoes and $100. And yeah, of course, I'll do it or fly you there. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So now hopefully we're a little bit mature and we can come to these discussions in a different way, in a more mature way. To me, the Olympics need us more than we need the Olympics. Mm. You know, and again, I'm not trying to say, no, don't do the Olympics. No, I think it could be an incredible opportunity for people. It would be great to have kids winning gold medals for breaking. So the opportunities could be great. But it's not something that, for myself, we want to put all our eggs in that basket. Mm.
And you have some specific concerns, it sounds like, with the rules, the way this is going to happen at the Olympic level. Tell us about those.
Yeah, so, you know, it's a tough thing. There is judging systems, and there's been an entire process, and it's, you know, it's created a lot of discussion in the community. who's creating the judging system, who's not involved, who's not involved. Should it be the, you know, the OGs, the veterans, or should it be the new school people? Or you can judge us, but it is an art. So how do you judge that?
It's subjective in some ways, yeah.
Absolutely, 100%. And if you start saying like, well, whoever does the most head spins, well, that's not really, it's not really about the most. Maybe who does the freshest, but then what's the definition of fresh? Mm. You know, who has a style? Because, you know, within the community, style is everything. So how do you judge style?
Yeah.
I mean, style is, you judge, style is what I have inside of me. Style is what I have when I walk into the room,
yeah.
the way I put on my clothes, the way. So how do you judge all those things?
Yeah, it reminds me of like the conversation around maybe like skateboarding as it mm-hmm. became a much more official and then Olympic 100%. Sport or snowboarding, even like gymnastics or something like that, where there is a lot of art form to the way in which you perform the sport. But there's got to be, if you're going to put it at an Olympic level, like an official and an objective way of judging it. It sounds like your concerns are really just in that, right? Like that this is, there's a line there.
Yeah, I mean, it's that in the, and skateboarding and snowboarding are perfect examples. And mm-hmm. I think that those are communities that we should be looking at because I think they've been doing a great job at it. You know, mm-hmm. you have skaters that are big, big ramp athletes and they're making money and they're famous. But you also have the street skaters that just do street skating, but they're also well known. They're also sponsored. They're also taken care of.
Interesting.
So I think they're finding a good balance between that.
Mm.
What the concern is that with things like the Olympics, you know, we call it the big stage competitions, right? That's the only thing that's going to matter now. And the, you know, for us, the streets is the ciphers. When you know you have a jam, you have the big stage contest, but then you're going to have 20 circles on the floor where it's just that's where the rawness is. Where that's where some of the best, you know, b-boys and b-girls are at.
Yeah.
So that's part of the concern is that we're only going to pay attention to the big stage now.
Sure.
And so the younger generation coming up is no longer concerned about this raw battle thing over here. I can't earn any money over here with you guys. I can't earn any recognition over here. Oftentimes we've criticized like choreography competitions, but even with these solo battles, that's what they're doing. They're doing sets, what we call sets now. So they're doing, you'll see them do the same exact set at 20 different competitions. So now that takes away. Now we're not having a conversation. Now it's just who practiced their routine the best, you know. And then the other side of it is that we're going into this I, which is affecting crews. Crews used to be a very big vital thing, your tribe, but now I don't need a crew because now all the competitions are one on one. So now I don't need this community thing anymore necessarily.
Mm. What you're talking about is abstract in a way. Like there is an opportunity here and maybe some really good things that come out of this. But it sounds like you're worried that something could very well be lost here. Like what does that mean to you, the kind of culture, the community that is around this?
I mean, the culture, the community is everything. The people, everything. Like I could go on YouTube and learn all the moves. Otherwise, it just becomes a sport.
All right. Leave it there. Jay Edson House Magana, Clinical Assistant Professor in the School of Music, Dance, and Theater at ASU and founder of the Furious Styles Crew.
Yep.
Thank you so much, House, for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. And here is a phrase you probably know.
So remember, only you can prevent forest fires.
That, of course, is Smokey Bear. And if you've noticed his image showing up on billboards and in ads again today, you're not alone. This year, today, in fact, marks his 80th birthday. The iconic bear has been telling us to put out our campfires and tie up chains behind our cars since 1944, when he first appeared on his first forest fire prevention campaign poster, Drowning a Campfire. But Smokey Bear is not just one of the most successful and longest-running ad campaigns in American history. He also was a real bear. Mary Levin is the manager of Smokey Bear Historical Park in Capitan, New Mexico, and she spoke more about it with my co-host Lauren Gilger as she was standing about 20 feet from the real Smokey Bear's gravesite.
A lot of folks are very familiar with the poster of Smokey Bear, but they don't know that there was a real story and a living symbol as well. So the state park was created when Smokey passed away so he could be laid to rest very near the place where he was found.
Yeah, I mean, you can count me among those folks. I did not know that there was a real Smokey Bear. So you have to start there with us. Like, tell us about the real bear, his story.
Okay, so in 1950, a forest fire started, a human-caused forest fire started in the Capitan Mountains, and a little bear cub was seen running around the fire and was badly burned and eventually got rescued from a wildland firefighter who brought him back to fire camp. And then he was turned over to the custody of a game warden who's sort of a local hero here, whose name was Ray Bell. And Ray is credited with the idea of connecting this living symbol of this tiny cub who was rescued from this fire to the national wildfire prevention icon, Smokey Bear. So the campaign actually came first in 1944. And as they say, the rest is history.
And the real Smokey lived in the Washington, D.C. zoo for 26 years, right? He's buried there at the park where you are, as you said.
Right.
Bring us back a little bit and talk about the impetus back then in, you know, 1950 of or even before that, of creating an ad campaign around preventing forest fires. Like, what was happening? What were they getting out of control? Were we just realizing this was a problem?
Right. Well, I'll just say there's roots to a much deeper story that goes way back, actually, to not too long after the Civil War, when one of the worst wildfires that claimed human lives in American history happened, believe it or not, in Wisconsin. So that was sort of on the minds of folks still, even though it was in the past. The Forest Service was created in 1905. Another huge catastrophic fire happened in 1910 called the Big Burn. So that's kind of the setup. Then fast forward into World War II. So enemy Axis powers were actually patrolling our Atlantic and Pacific seaboards with the intent to light incendiary fire bombs and start our forests on fire because second only to ammunition, the most valuable commodity for the war effort was wood and paper products. So it's tied to this much deeper thread of American history and all kinds of things. So fast forward, the National War Ad Council at the time got together with the Forest Service and decided to create a very appealing ad campaign for American people to basically be invited into the story, to kind of be watchers in the woods, and then also to be careful with their own campfires and activities that could possibly cause a wildfire. So in 1942, the movie Bambi came out, and of course that had, you know, little Bambi and his mom and all his forest friends, you know, running from a wildfire.
Get up, Bambi. Get up. You must get up. Get up. Get up. No. Come with me.
So Bambi was actually the first icon used in this campaign, but Disney only loaned him out for a year, so they had to come up with a new icon. So they thought about, you know, a fox and a squirrel, and then finally somebody's like, hey, we should do a bear, because a bear is big and strong, you know, you can put a pair of jeans on him, put a ranger hat, give him a shovel, and, you know, if a bear tells you to do something, you're going to pay attention and do what he says. So that's how Smokey was born.
Smokey the Bear! Smokey the Bear!
Hello there, folks! This is Smokey, the forest fire preventing bear.
A year after they introduced the Smokey Bear wildfire prevention campaign, human-caused wildfires went down by 70%.
My goodness.
It was incredibly successful.
So let's talk about the ads for a moment, because they're so iconic, like from print ads and posters and billboards and things like that. You know, you know the picture, you know the bear and the jeans with the hat, and, you know, only you can prevent forest fires. There were radio ads, there were television ads. Do you have any favorites? Do any stand out to you?
Oh, I was a child of the 70s. And so I think, you know, in all honesty, one of my favorites is a television spot of all things that was done by Ray Charles, where the screen is completely dark and all you hear is sound of footprints walking through, crunching through the leaves.
I like the way the forest sounds, the way the leaves rustle in the wind and fall to the ground and crunch under your feet, the way the birds sing and the chipmunks chatter, the way a squirrel scrambles up a tree. That's why I'm asking you to please be careful with fire. Because when we lose a forest, we lose a lot more than meets the eye. I ought to know. I'm Ray Charles.
Okay, so let's talk about his message for a moment. You mentioned how effective it was right off the top. And there's a real, like, optimism to this, right? Like, that we can all do something to help, to prevent wildfires, to do something important here. We know most wildfires are still caused by humans today. But I think also, like, how we understand wildfires has really changed over the years that Smokey has been around. Like, we now know that it was our suppression of all wildfires that has created more of these catastrophic wildfires, right? That we put out too many, and that some fire is healthy for forests and we've let them become overgrown, et cetera. I wonder, like, how that shift in how we think about and what we know about wildfire and fire and forests in general has changed the message, or has it?
Mm-hmm. It has. So that's really, really a good question and great observation. Fire has always been on the landscape, specifically in the West and the Southwest. I can speak to that being in New Mexico. The forests and the woodlands and the grasslands are actually fire adapted. It's complicated to go back and look and see why were fires suppressed so intently. So looking forward, we have this incredible inheritance of natural resources that are preserved for us in our national forests, our national parks, state forests, wild places, if you will. Mm. So Smokey's message speaks to that in that we all have a role to play. How do we go from an unhealthy forest that typically right now is overstocked? So when that really important piece of wildfire, the right kind of fire at the right time, mm-hmm. is removed from the equation for 100 years plus, how do we manage the forests and the woodlands and the grasslands? When you understand the history and the mindset of those people at the time, it made a lot of sense. So if we kind of do a throwback to what I mentioned a few minutes ago of this catastrophic fire in Peshtigo, Wisconsin, that killed over 2,000 people, that was fresh in people's minds, right? When their response to wildfire is it's always bad all the time. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's not true.
Yeah. So Smokey is back. We're seeing billboards of him around town today. It's his 80th birthday this year. And I know there are lots of events there and around the country to celebrate him. I wonder, like, has he gotten a makeover? Like, does Smokey look the same now as he used to? He seems a little more muscular to me.
Right. So, I mean, it's really fun to kind of look back at the early days, and he was a little heavier set, maybe a little bit. In some of the initial ones, he was a little bit more serious, and now you see him smiling and a little more lively and inviting. And it's really fun to take a look at how he's changed over time, and the message is the same. Only you can prevent wildfires now. So I think his message is foundational, and maybe his smile has gotten a little brighter. Maybe the twinkle in his eye is a little more, how would you say, more mature with the times we're in now. But he's still, you know, at the heart, Smokey Bear. Why does this matter? Now more than ever before, because conditions are, you know, set up for these catastrophic wildfires. The message, I don't think, needs to change. We just need to reach deeper and broader and wider and invite people in to understand.
Yeah. All right. Well, we will leave it there for now. That is Mary Levin, manager of Smokey Bear Historical Park in New Mexico. Mary, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for doing this. I appreciate it very much.
It was my pleasure, and thank you so much. And happy birthday, Smokey Bear.
Yeah.
Always sniffing at the breeze. People stop and pay attention when he tells them to beware, 'cause everybody knows that he's the fire preventing bear. Smokey the Bear.
Smokey the Bear.
This song, sung by Gene Autry, is actually the reason a lot of us call him Smokey the Bear, but Mary Levin wanted us all to know it's actually Smokey Bear, unless, of course, you're singing along.
You can take a tip from Smokey that there's nothing like a tree, 'cause they're good for kids to climb in and they're beautiful to see. You just have to look around you and you'll find it's not a joke to see what you'd be missing if they all went up in smoke. Smokey the Bear.
Smokey the Bear.
Prowling and a growling and a sniffing the air. He can find a fire, before it starts to flame. That's why they call.
And that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for listening. The show was produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, Ayanna Hamilton, Gabriella Fernbaugh, and our reporter Sam Dingman, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, Chad Snow, our news director. The show is created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. And today we say goodbye to Gabby Fernbaugh as her internship ends. Thank you so much, Gabby, for all of your hard work over the past few months. And of course, good luck. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday.
Home, you can run and hunt and ramble anywhere you care to roam. He will let you take his honey and pretend he's not so smart, but don't you harm